So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, with me today again, is Charlie Peters, Senior Executive Vice President of Emerson. Hi, Charlie, and welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Adrian. I really look forward to this.
Fantastic. So, Charlie, would you be so kind as to remind our readers and listeners about you and the work that you do?
Yes, I'm in the top executive group at Emerson. I've been here nearly 40 years, and my job is to work on kind of strategy in the future. I deal with a lot of topics around information. Generally, what I try to do is take our manufacturing company that was so hugely successful in the 20th century and transform it to what I call the new business models and the new business age, probably more where companies trade on information and knowledge than purely their ability to manufacture or produce goods.
So would I be right in saying that you are a seer or a sage for Emerson?
Well, I hope I am. Whether I am or not remains to be seen, but I certainly put a lot of effort into trying to do that.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, by the looks of your results, you must be doing a pretty good job so far.
Okay, well, thank you.
So, well, when we spoke earlier, when we were organizing this, you mentioned some ideas about something that you'd notice about a distinction in the differences between business-to-business and business-to-consumer marketing and some of the pitfalls that you think or that you're seeing that some business-to-business marketers are falling into. Can you tell me a bit more about that and what you've noticed and what you think business-to-business marketers can do to make sure they don't make the same mistakes as that others are making?
Well, I think if you take the B2C world where companies sell to consumers, you've seen a lot of this transformation already take place. Of course, probably Amazon, and for those of us in the United States, is the biggest indicator of the shift. And as consumers, we increasingly buy more and more online. And as it relates to B2B, I would say 90% of Emerson's business is B2B. The transformation that was predicted in 2000 hasn't occurred nearly as rapidly, and I think there's a lot of inertia and perhaps a lot of confidence that we can continue in the old mode. But I think that B2B marketers need to first look very closely at the B2C world, look at what has occurred, and try to garner lessons and layer them on top of the business models that we play in the B2B world.
Right. And now you talk about there's sort of two things in what you're saying there. You talked about this transformation that was predicted in sort of 2000, and then also you mentioned sort of inertia. Can you tell me a little bit, refresh my memory about the transformation that was predicted? I mean, what was the if you like, the future prediction that was made back in the turn of the millennium?
Well, the world had a major event called Y2K. And so if you're in the late 90s in any large enterprise, all of your IT resources were placed on these large projects to get us through the famous Y2K and avoid the catastrophe that some predicted. And when we got on the other side of Y2K, we had these large project teams. We then started focusing on the impact of digital. Mm-hmm. And whether it was B2C or B2B, there were these significant predictions of a rapid changeover where everything was going to be sold online. And all business models were going to be so-called transformed, and distribution channels were going to go away. And I would say that it happened to some degree and continues to happen in the B2C world at a reasonable pace. But close to 15 years later in the B2B world, it kind of didn't happen. And I think that gave people some comfort. And I view that as maybe a pitfall that B2B marketers like those within Emerson, with which I work, are falling into, because they're kind of lulled into sleep and think that this is not going to happen. But actually think we're kind of at an inflection point where in some businesses it's happening very rapidly. And I will note one observation. The pace of change, even within the B2B world, varies by distribution and business based on a number of factors.
Okay. And what would you say those factors were?
The first factor is, I think that the two things you have to look at are who specifically are the customers and the decision makers, and how their propensity to buy online. And then secondly, what is the value added structure and how amenable is that to shifting to online, each of the elements of the value added structure.
Yeah.
So if you take a business where, like IT, people who buy IT equipment, you'll find that they are very comfortable with technology, have a lot of belief, are very much on the leading edge or ahead of all things digital. And so there's a significant propensity for them to move online. And so those product areas that we sell into that are more apt to shift to that. Then if you look at what pieces of the value chain get disrupted, it's everything from payment to logistics to how we initially communicate our products. Products that are very hard to apply or customized or heavily configured, in the B2B world, they're much more complex and they're less likely to shift to the new online environment versus things that are more standard or that can just be bought out of a catalog, where the value add that distributors historically have applied is much easier to do online. So those are kind of the two analyses I do, is how willing is the customer to accept digital?
Right.
And what are the pieces of the value add that distribution plays, and how can those be replaced online? And when you do that analysis, you come up with some really fascinating situations that shift one way or another. But I think as a general rule, many businesses are in the B2B world are at somewhat of an inflection point, and the rate of shift is increasing.
Right. I mean, I just think the when you talk about, you know, particularly when you talk about B2B and you talk about manufacturing and the use of digital and configuration and also the whole, in, if you like, the economics of manufacturing and various kind of guises. I mean, it makes me think of a business to consumer example where you say, for example, there's, say, car manufacturing, which isn't selling into a business to business market, but it's possibly selling into a business to consumer market. And you see these, if you like, online configurators where you can go and select a model and then select engine size and all the different features and extras and paint jobs and finishes, et cetera, where, and then the car in theory gets made on demand. Is that too simplified an approach for the business to business market, or actually
I think that's a good example of a relatively complex B2C product. So that would actually give you some vision into how the B2B world works. I mean, keep in mind, when you're dealing in B2B and comparing it to B2C, just as a generalization, you're dealing with complex products, you're dealing with multiple decision makers, you're dealing with higher risk purchases, and you're dealing with a protracted relationship. So your automobile example probably hits 3 out of 4 of those. I would say you're not dealing with multiple decision makers in the decision, but it's certainly a complex product. It's a high-risk purchase in that you're actually committing quite a bit of your significant economics. And it's what I call a protracted purchase because you also have an ongoing relationship with service.
Yes.
So it has probably 3 of the 4 dimensions of how I draw a distinction between B2B and B2C. And I do think you can garner lessons from that. And, you know, you can start to think about price transparency, that suddenly how the whole pricing paradigm has changed. You know, my ability to negotiate at a car dealer that I was great at in the 80s or 90s is kind of being obsoleted.
And
the whole dealer structure, the number of dealers, the number of automobile dealers is decreasing, and their business model are changing. So, yes, that's a really good example to maybe try to layer onto the B2B world and, you know, like I say, garner some lessons.
It makes me think in terms of you said it covers three of the four different options, and the one option doesn't cover is complex decision making. I guess then that, you know, rather than just refuting that as a way of operating, I guess you could flip that and you could say, oh, actually, that possibly offers an opportunity for some B2B firms where actually you change the selling model into being something which is slightly more consultative, in that you help people, you walk people through the decision making, as it were, and all the options. But the technology is there just to, if you like, capture the decision making. If that makes sense.
Well, in that sentence, you captured kind of the essence of my job.
Oh, okay.
Because as a manufacturer, in the 20th century, we distinguished ourselves on manufacturing scale and technology, and all, and cost advantage was king. Mm-hmm. And today, you're facing a dramatically larger number of global scale competitors, such as, you know, we talk about the Chinese mid-tier, but you've got many more competitors who have access to this technology and these cost positions. So manufacturing's become dramatically more equal in terms of the production side of the equation. But in Emerson, where we've been the technology leader for many decades, and we have this deep vertical presence and large market share and a strong knowledge of the application, what I try to emphasize to our management group is we've got to start trading on that capability as opposed to our capability as an excellence in manufacturing. We have to be equal to everyone else in manufacturing. But in essence, we're the company to go to, I'll use your word, for the consult.
Yes.
And that's how we maintain our market share, and ultimately how we maybe have the potential to increase our profitability, because I'm convinced that trading on information has higher profit potential than just trading on hardware.
Yeah. And I mean, it also makes me think that actually the competitive advantage is, as you say, potentially within the consult, but actually your ability to build trust at that point of interface, and actually throughout the relationship.
Well, when I sat down to talk to you and I made my list of words to maybe convey in this conversation, trust is one of my three or four words, and I think it's really fascinating. And really, the question that you have is, if you go to the historical B2B model, The local distributor or local agent or local representative, part of their value add was trust.
Yeah.
And it raises the question of, you can go through and kind of logically think through this whole logistics, payment, you know, you can look at Amazon and delivering in 24 hours, and you can create whole new inventory models, and, you know, you can get tremendous efficiency through the system and online payments and all this piece of the value add. But at the end of the day, there's this dimension of trust, and probably what I lay awake now thinking about is, how does that play out over the next two decades? And I think in our original conversation, we talked about local versus global and having local representation and how that fit into these models. And I think that's a big piece of this discussion, is how does a new B2B marketer create trust in this world, and to what degree is that based on local representation as opposed to kind of global or holistic that plays across the whole customer base and whole geography.
Excellent. That's Yeah, that's a really good point. But then you also kind of talked about the value of information, and that sort of relates back to something else we talked about, which was you made a point to me about big data versus little data, and why there's value in both approaches, and that we can learn insights and lessons from, you know, from other firms and how they can use that, and actually how it's important not to ignore one at the expense of another. So can you tell me a little bit more about that big data versus little data sort of?
Yeah, I think this is probably the biggest pitfall for global enterprises. The world-class B2B organizations like Emerson are, you know, at real risk here, because big data versus little data is, to me, kind of old school versus new school.
Right.
And the new school blank slates have a huge advantage in the way they think about it. So let me draw a distinction between big data and little data. I call little data kind of narrow.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of singular parameter, a simplistic mainstream way of looking at something.
Uh-huh.
And historically, enterprises like Emerson have done this with very what's called structured data approaches.
Mm-hmm.
So you decide what parameters impact the decision. You go gather that data, you structure it, you put it in a database, and you go on and you continually do that analysis. Now, there's this whole new world of big data, which actually takes a very different philosophy. And it takes a philosophy that the insights are yet to be discovered.
Right.
And that there are insights in large data sets, but that the true insight is in the diversity of the data. And big data is very welcoming in its very nature and framework to all different types of data. So it's not just structured databases of digital information, of numbers, let's say, that are in the famous relational database.
Yeah.
But it's a construct where you basically go out and search for any type of data. It may be text,
mm-hmm.
It may be web logs,
mm-hmm.
It may be images,
right.
It may be videos, it may be blogs.
Yeah.
And it can be structured data that exists already in your company. And so if I'm in a little data world, I'm typically just looking at structured data within my company. If I open my mind to big data, I say, ultimately, all of these different types of data are going to impact my decision, give me foresight. And as a consequence, I'm going to build a construct that is, as I say, welcoming to this, brings it in and allows me to learn and adapt and expand over time. And I think that last paragraph is very difficult for enterprises like an Emerson that are very traditional and have ways of doing that. They have famous business intelligence tools and everything. And it's the advantage to the new entrant. And if I go back to your original premise, which is knowledge will be the real differentiator, I think the real differentiator will be the ability to get into these big data models, because the implication is there's much deeper knowledge and insight available from this much more diverse, broader, and open-minded analytical approach than what we've used traditionally.
I agree. I mean, there's two things that occurred to me then. Is one is that that I was speaking to a chap by the name of Vivek Jetley from EXL, and he's a bit of a data analytics scientist sort of guy, and he said there's, you know, one of the big challenges for the big data sort of issue and for firms to try and capture the opportunity is the lack of actual real data skills, whether scientists, people that understand it sort of operationally and strategically. And so there's a real data skills gap. And the second thing, I guess, is that with data is that, well, I guess one of the things is it's almost a bit like accounting data. It's almost, does it not suffer from being purely historical, and it's not therefore not necessarily a good predictor of the future?
Well, I think that he's right on that we lack real data skills, and we especially lack the skills of the big data tools.
Yeah.
And the big data tools are in this mode right now. Literally, as we speak, the phenomena of big data tools is what's called real time. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I think the traditionalists have looked at history as a predictor of the future, and where big data is going right now is kind of a real-time assessment and reaction. So it's almost a different mode of analysis.
Yeah.
But I guess I'll answer you in kind of my own personal commitment to this. I've thought a lot about it, and I've talked to the big data companies, and I've decided that I'm going to try to find some 22-year-old person who just graduated from college, and I'm sitting at home now making lists of analyses I'd like to do, and I'm going to get a computer and sit down with this person, and we're just going to start doing analyses, start building some models, and, you know, kind of just jump in the deep end.
Yeah.
And my compatriots have said, why don't you keep a diary of your experiences? So I think that that's really what's going to be necessary for somebody like me to really, really deeply understand this chasm that we've got to cross, and really bring these capabilities to Emerson so we can continue to differentiate ourselves as a company.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to explain myself slightly better, I'm just thinking about it as you were talking, and it seems to me that there's a that we talk about the skills gaps and the opportunity and challenge that is in front of firms. And I think there seems to me there's two different types of skills requirements. One is understanding the data that we have and therefore understanding amongst all the complexity of what's happened and why it's happened. And then that's one distinct skill. And then there's another skill, which is, right, now let's look forward and figure out, with all the things that are happening in the world, what are the likely scenarios that will play out in the future? And I think they're two very, very distinct skills, like understanding history and then looking to the future, I think are two very different skill sets. And I think you probably want to try and find somebody who can do both.
Yeah, and especially to do the second one, you're going to have to start integrating lots and lots of different data types that people really haven't thought about. So that actually becomes really practical. So my little exercise to jump into the deep end, I'm kind of plotting. I'm making lists of 6 or 7 different data types, and I kind of don't want to come up for air until I kind of, in my little team, mastered how do you accommodate all of these things. But you're right, building predictive models is ultimately what we're going to do, and there's going to be probability statistics around each of those predictions. And so you're going to have to develop a facility to think like that, and then we're going to have to think about how do we apply it to our decision-making and our investments.
It's funny because I was in a meeting this morning, and the topic of scenario planning came up, and I was telling the people there that some years ago I used to work for Shell, and Shell is one of the originators of scenario planning, and it feels like to me that actually things like with the advent of big data and predictive models and things, that there might be space for a return of or a rise in popularity again of scenario planning.
Right, and I use the term simulation. We have some simulation models, and I think what's really different is for every unknown or every variable there, I think big data affords you the chance to maybe go look and get more accuracy or get more insight around those variables and be able to build stronger causality and better simulations. So we use the term high fidelity simulation. We kind of rate our simulations around the word fidelity, and I think big data gives you the chance to increase the fidelity of your simulations.
I like that. So, Charlie, I mean, I the focus, the primary focus of my blog is about looking at trends and insights in service and experience, customer service and customer experience. But you know, given your role as in many ways a bit of a futurist for Emerson, what are you seeing as some of the big issues that firms are grappling with right now, or kind of that are coming up on the horizon that that you think that's on my radar? That's something that I think that we need to grapple with, and I think other firms are going to need to grapple with too.
I think there's two phenomena that are crashing together and pointing everything at the same direction, which is that this whole word about solution, but as we serve our customers increasingly want pretty much everything done for them.
Right.
And so they are very willing to pay for a complete solution, again, in terms of the protracted relationship that you have with the customer. And I think the two phenomena are, one, there's a general loss of skills in our vertical industries, there's lesser skills, either through kind of retirement or the aging of the skill base, and or the fact that many of our applications are finding their way into the emerging parts of the world that don't have the deep skill bases that maybe we had in the Western world throughout the years. The second thing is the whole generational shift, and those of us from the baby boomer generation really have to acknowledge that the millennials have a whole different attitude and have aptitudes that are greater in some areas and less in other areas. And all of this points to an expectation among an increasing part of the customer base that when they have a problem or have a need, they want their supplier to completely deliver on that. So it's not only tell me I have a problem, but, you know, tell me what we're going to do about it and help me get it done. And, you know, I just want to click a button and have that problem go away because my life is so cluttered in many other ways, one. And secondly, I trust you to do that.
Right. So do you think that there is a potential, I mean, on the assumption that deep skill sets are going to be required, particularly for more advanced industries and advanced manufacturing and technology and things, and also to drive progress. Do you think that there's possibility that you talk about the millennial generation? Does that generation possibly suffer from a depth of skills and also possibly a self-awareness about kind of what is required going forward?
Yeah, I think they certainly have a lot of digital aptitude. So that is a good starting point. But whether they have the analytical chops, as we say,
yeah,
or you know, the curiosity is probably an open question. I'm certainly not ready to judge one way or the other, but when you get into this analytical realm, curiosity and drive to a final and complete answer is kind of a special trait.
Yeah.
And it remains to be seen how well the millennials will do on that. But this analytical discussion we're having, I think it's really critical that we find people with that type of aptitude.
Yeah, excellent. So is there anything else that Charlie, that you've got that on your sort of radar or on your list right now that you think that I'm putting a watching brief on that, and it's something I think that our readers and listeners should be looking at too?
Well, as I emphasized, I think last time, this whole thing of local marketing and you know, what is the size of the community? And it really gets back to that trust word that we talked about.
Yeah.
I really believe future marketing models are going to have to change and be a hybrid format. And then I think that one of the things I'm really working on a lot now is China, and it's a fascinating contradiction of this whole discussion, because on the e-commerce side, it's racing ahead at a much faster rate.
Right.
But when you look at this trust element that the local agent or distributor gives, it is a huge part of their kind of transactional B2B world. And I am just befuddled on how the e-commerce online model is going to fulfill that trust value added in China. And I only bring that up to you because I think it is such an extreme example. It helps. It certainly helps me frame what this whole issue is about, this transformation of B2B and that word you suggested, trust.
And so just so I'm clear, do you mean that they have the e-commerce capability, but they don't necessarily have the boots on the ground?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. I think a B2B transaction in China, because there's such a dearth of information in China over the last 20 years, they've had to rely on local people, call them agents, who had a relationship, who were known to the decision makers, and they conveyed or engendered trust in that decision and allowed the transaction to occur.
Right.
Now suddenly you look at China and you say, on one hand, they're dramatically more advanced than the Western world in terms of the ability to do online transactions.
Right.
But how are you going to get that trust value add in there into the transaction? And that really baffles me, because it's like the best of times and the worst of times type of thing. It's the best of the e-commerce world and the most challenging of the e-commerce world.
Excellent.
So I find a lot of, I'm deeply interested in looking at China because I find it very instructive in this broader issue you and I are discussing.
Excellent. Well, Charlie, that's, as always, that's fascinating. And real huge kind of amounts of food for thought. But one final thing before we call this to an end, is there anything that you'd like to plug shamelessly?
I just think that it conveys, obviously I work for Emerson, I work in these industries, and I think it's companies like Emerson that have this foresight, that are willing to re-examine their companies and their business models, that have the greatest opportunity. And these things may not play out in the next year or two, but I think they're foundational to doing business effectively in the 21st century.
Indeed. Charlie, as ever, thank you very much for being so generous with your time and your insights. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.